Hi, Nthread listeners. Mira from Canada 2020 here. I just wanted to give you a heads up that the last few minutes of this episode contain stronger than normal language for our show. For nearly 35 years, Interac has brought the most innovative payment technology to Canada. Today, Interac is building on its track record of innovation in some exciting new ways. Find out how they're changing the game at developer.interac.ca.
Hi, Nthread listeners. It's Friday, January 11th. Happy New Year. This is our first episode of 2019. Joining me in the studio is Susan Delacour of the Toronto Star and David Reevely of the Canadian Press. How are you both? Did you have good breaks?
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty good.
Good.
Worked through much of it, but yeah. Christmas is kind of, it's fun to work through Christmas when you're a journalist.
Yeah, okay, actually. Right. Yeah. And it's always chaotic. It's good to get a little bit of a break. Okay, let's get right into it. It was a big week. First up, whether you watched it or not, I'm sure you were all aware that U.S. President Donald Trump formally addressed the nation and the rest of the world on Tuesday night to stress what he calls a major security crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. So his proposed way of handling this, obviously, as we know, is to build a wall. And there seems to, we'll get into this, but there seems to be just like, I'm fascinated by sort of the physicality and the symbolic nature of the wall. But the night that he addressed this was also the 18th day of the government shutdown. So let's talk about the structure of this primetime address. What was the president's strategy using this platform, this primetime address, as a way to talk about this specific issue? Did it deserve primetime attention, do you think, Susan?
Whenever a president goes on the air, it did deserve, I guess, the coverage. I think there was that debate about that. What I found odd about the address is that this is a president who has championed himself as an outside Washington guy, you know, the rebels at the gates. And here he is sitting with all the trappings of the government around him.
And the trumpets are going out. Yeah.
The medium or the venue did not suit the message, which is I'm here to knock this place down. And then he was using the very office to make his point. And I think that's why it was so ineffective. This guy has basically one place where he does messages well, depending on what you think is as well, effectively, and that is rallies. And there was nothing he said in that address that he couldn't have said at a rally. And I don't think if the goal was persuasion, I'm not sure he persuaded anyone.
Yeah. I think if it was, from what I took of it, it was the introduction of new language around like humanitarian crisis and really trying to, he only mentioned the wall, I think, a couple of times. And it was almost like he was trying to get to a new base, like reach a new base of not his usual, you know, wall crying constituents, more like the people who are a bit more moderate and who are going, I don't know, is there reasoning behind this? So we talked a lot about technology and human resources and it being humanitarian, you know, crisis. But the actual, the wall mentioning was minimal. And but it's true. He didn't say anything new, really, because all that was new is that it might be made of steel and not concrete, I think.
Yeah, which was strange. He said, you know, because as a Democrat's request, we'll build it out of steel or steel rather than concrete, which is not a thing I think anyone has been able to trace to any actual Democrat. So it's just an odd thing to say. I mean, I think to Susan's point, the when the president speaks from the Oval Office, historically, it is, you know, he is speaking as it has always been. He is speaking as president, not as a politician, but as the leader of the country. This is for occasions of war. This is for when there are very serious things that the president must say to the people of the United States. And this was a very political speech. This was Donald Trump, Republican Party leader, just pushing for his preferred solution to a problem that is only sort of a problem. It's a problem largely of his own creation. And you talk about the humanitarian dimension, which is significant, but also largely of Trump's and the U.S. government's creation, that there are people crossing in the desert, dying of thirst in some cases. Yeah. Terrible things are, you know, happening to people who are at the mercy of human smugglers. There are other ways of dealing with this problem other than putting up a wall and making it even harder for those who are really desperate to try to get into the United States to do it.
I think, too, like the humanitarian element of that is, I think he was meaning it to refer to the impact it has on Americans and not a huge humanitarian element for migrants who are coming across. But, you know, the impact on Americans is...
It's a strange message to hear from Donald Trump as well.
Yeah.
I mean, who is his self-declared brand is as a tough guy.
Right.
And it's just not – it's a tough sell for him. He would have had to have been much defter in the execution than he has ever been in the public eye before.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's not for me to say whether he pulled it off, but it was a huge challenge he gave himself.
Yeah.
Whenever I watch Donald Trump, I think – how far we have come in 2 years even in normalizing his behavior and his language. And for a president to get up and deliver such an anti-immigration message, to equate immigration and refugees and would-be refugees with crime and murder and all of these things, this is something you would have heard on alt-right radio.
Yeah.
2 years ago, you never would have thought the president of the United States would be saying this on the air. And I constantly check myself and say, don't begin to accept these things as normal, because for somebody or for anyone who believes in immigration, which technically should be anybody except Indigenous Americans and Canadians, a horrifying message to hear is that people coming to the United States are basically criminals and thugs and rapists.
Returning to the shutdown, which is the fallout of both sides. I think it's easy to say, you know, Trump is causing a government shutdown. Well, it's both sides not getting to the table and agreeing on something.
Yeah, let me. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay,
you.
Okay.
Tell you what, finish the question.
I was just going to say, I think today. So today is the day. Actually, it was payday. Then they're not being paid. I don't see an out here, because I think both sides are stubborn on this, and I don't see how he's going to ever let down on the wall per se, but I want to talk about the symbolic nature of this wall, but go ahead.
Sure. It's true. The two sides have not agreed. And in that sense, it is both the Democrats and the Republicans and Trump's responsibility. But if one person is demanding something absurd and the other side is not giving it to him, I mean, yes, in a sense, both sides are parties to it, but
right.
I mean, he's asking for a very large amount of money to do very little to solve problems that are almost non-existent in the way, at least, that he describes them. So, yeah, the Democrats aren't giving it to him. But it's not a 50-50
kind
of a thing.
And he walked out on negotiations or whatever.
And in fact, there was earlier on in his presidency, there was $25 billion. This is over just under $6 billion. It's a lot of money. But there was $25 billion on the table for substantial improvements to physical border security.
Yes.
If he would sign off on a path to citizenship for people brought to the United States as children illegally, and he wouldn't do it.
Right.
There could be a wall, you know, half built now if he'd gone for that.
Again, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but, you know, the idea that a wall solves your border problems is a ridiculous idea. And also the idea, you know, people arrive by all kinds of means into the United States as well, planes, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, I do think we have to remember that this is sort of a medieval answer to a modern problem, right? It's what you would expect from a guy of the 20th century to think that the answer was a wall, right? Like, the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, and we kind of thought we were done with walls then.
Yeah.
But, again,
it's Trump. Know. Okay, moving on. So, as Susan rightly predicted, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau would be shuffling his government, and it turns out. It's on Monday. This comes after news that longtime Nova Scotia MP and President of the Treasury Board of Canada, Scott Bryson, would be leaving his post. And he announced that yesterday afternoon. So what? How did you know?
I'm not going to tell that. It'll be the last scoop I ever get.
I know.
No, you just you know, you just listen to what's in the wind out there, and you know, for would-be reporters out there, there is a way of getting a confirmation by not getting a denial. I'm very wary of that usually, but there, when you ask a pointed question and you don't get an answer, is sort of. So the minute I wrote that story, I started to have this escalating crisis of confidence that I was wrong.
Yes, of course.
But I was assured later that night that I was right.
Yes.
And yesterday we saw Scott Bryson is the beginning of the fall of the dominoes. I still don't know, and I'm hoping you don't expect me to predict any more about what's happening with the shuffle, because I don't know. I don't know. And I don't know that many people, even the ones who are moving, May know right now.
I mean, it's crazy. It's on Monday. You'd think that it would, but I mean,
this is a leaky town.
It's a leaky town. Yeah. Did Bryson though surprise you, or is that someone that he's 51. He's got two young twins. I guess, you know, does that surprise you at all?
I've known Scott for a long time, and I knew that. His partner Max is a really, really lovely man, and I knew that having twin daughters is a struggle for any parent, and that is particularly difficult. Mr. Bryson was lucky enough that he had a job that he could hang around Ottawa. You know, that Treasury Board president doesn't have to travel the country all that much. But I do think that it was. I do think Max is a very happy man today.
Yes. And David, do you think it's a lot of people are talking about this tie-in to the Vice Admiral Mark Norman affair? Yes. Do you think that is even something that should be mentioned?
Yes, I do. I think there are probably a lot of factors here.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to... They all stack up, and eventually a politician reaches the point where he or she decides, I'm out. I think the pull of family is real and significant, and the twins were, I guess, babies at the time of the last election. And as demanding as babies are, four-year-olds are in their way even more demanding, and you start to realize just how much attention they require. And Bryson's husband has been doing a lot of that. I don't question that is a very significant element in all
this.
Yeah,
it would be for anyone.
He's 51. It is. There's time for him to change tracks, to make pots of money as well before he retires. And there is the Norman case. And that
Can you set that up a little? Yeah.
So Mark Norman was second in command of the Canadian military, and he is facing trial here in Ottawa for breach of trust, which is a thing really only public officials get charged with. Mm-hmm. And the allegation is that he leaked secrets to a shipyard that was on the verge of losing a Navy contract to refit a container ship to make it a provisioning ship for the Navy. The allegation is that he leaked these secrets in order to make sure that they – to pressure the government in order to make sure the shipyard got the,
right.
got the contract. The defense, among many other things, says that he was not the only person leaking these things, and it is not right or proper that Norman is the only guy who's on the spot. For example, look at all the things that Scott Bryson leaked, they say.
Right.
There are two shipyards. One of them is Irving. They're in Nova Scotia. Bryson represents Nova Scotia as the regional guy there. The other is Davie. They're in Quebec City. There are heavy politics involved. But this is all going to go to trial starting currently scheduled for late August.
August, right.
And is going to go on for a while. And that is right smack dab in the middle of the next federal election campaign. And if the testimony, I mean, the facts will not be determined legally probably until after the election, but the testimony could be quite politically problematic for the government.
And
it sure will be helpful for the Liberals to be able to say, Scott Bryson is not in the government anymore.
He doesn't represent.
He's not us. We're not him anymore.
Gosh.
So that's got to be a major consideration, at least.
Yeah. That's interesting to me.
Yeah.
The timing of that. Yeah.
Yes. I did ask whether that had to do with anything and was assured it did not. But right. then what would they say?
Yeah. Right? What would they say? Yeah. Like, you can speculate on that too much. But I mean, yeah, like it's just.
I think what David says is right.
Yeah.
You know, that this would not be have been helpful.
No,
at all.
Remember, I was telling you guys before we started recording that Bryson was also the Minister of Digital Government, which is interesting because that hasn't totally been talked about a lot since he announced. And that's also going to be a huge issue going forward before the next election, and something that's pretty controversial and that there's already pressures that the government should be doing more when it comes to digital government. I have a question, though. So another minister has to come from that region, mm-hmm. is it, Susan?
Yep.
Doesn't have to.
No.
Is not, there's no legal obligation.
Okay.
But politically, you know, the regions should be represented at the cabinet table.
Right.
And Bryson's a fairly heavy hitter from Atlantic Canada and Nova Scotia specifically.
And would he, whoever gets elected in, would they not automatically take over the Treasury,
no.
obviously? And that probably wouldn't be.
That's what I think has made this shuffle bigger. I think if Bryson was just resigning and somebody was being put into his job, that would be one of those tiny things that we get a press release about that happened up at Rideau Hall without the media there.
Right.
I think the fact that the media is being summoned means that they found somebody else for Treasury, and that this always happens in shuffles. The digital government thing. Surprises me. Shouldn't every minister be a minister of digital government these days?
It's like, so true.
I don't understand how a way of doing government is a government. Shouldn't everybody be doing digital government in this government? And also,
totally.
I think if before they do anything more digitally, I'd like them to fix the Phoenix thing. I think it's
I
do think that
that's
a really undercovered or underappreciated story outside the Ottawa bubble, but it is an example mm-hmm. of what happens when the government thinks that it just gets too clever by half on digital or technology stuff. So,
absolutely.
Putting the label on digital government is that being said, I think they are making some progress. I think Carla Qualtro is one of the people that may move in this shuffle, and it's just a guess.
Yeah.
Uneducated.
I'm putting my chips on you, though.
Well, it's just she did such a good job. She's a very adept performer. I think she's almost wasted where she is right now.
Yeah.
And I would put her I would give her a more strong role. I think they need communicators out there in this election year more than ever, and she's one of their strongest ones.
Now, it wouldn't be wise, I imagine, to do such a big shuffle that it appears like you weren't confident in any of the people that you had
at the front benches,
right? So I imagine it's not going to be crazy.
These things are always tricky.
Yeah, they're strategic.
And as soon as you move one, then you have to move somebody else.
Domino
and
effect.
And before you know it, the whole cabinet's moved.
Then
you got to start over again and say, all right, how far do we have to go?
A couple of backbenchers they need to put in, too, just to keep hope alive in that backbench.
Yeah.
Because, you know, morale can be a problem in an election year, especially when for the people who've been toiling away in obscurity, who gave up good jobs 4 years ago, to come in and sit and vote. And that's about it. So I think a couple of signals to backbenchers that, you know, there's a cabinet future here, I think would be very good for morale as we go into an election year. A lot of them, you don't have to go far to find a Liberal backbencher who's saying, you know, was that really the right idea?
Right.
It's not a bad job, but it's, again, people outside here don't realize how crappy a job it can be, too.
Yeah.
It's very demanding. It's really grueling, especially if you're from, you have to travel any distance to get to Ottawa. It's hard.
Yeah.
And have kids.
You meant, just lastly, before we go on, you mentioned in your piece that that he wouldn't be doing a throne speech. And I didn't realize that that's actually very, that's really unusual.
Totally
rare.
Yeah.
Because that resets the government going into an election,
tells you. Nobody outside Ottawa cares whether they're throne speeches or not, but I care about them. I think they're often interesting to they're an admission to Canadians that the world has changed since I got elected, mm-hmm. and here's how I've adjusted my plan accordingly. They're often really reflective of what they've learned when they're in power. And the idea, I thought it was kind of glib, mm-hmm. what the Prime Minister told me in the interview, is that, you know, we gave ourselves enough things to do the last 4 years, so we don't need another throne speech.
Right.
I've been wondering if they don't want Julie Payette to do it. That's
she speaks really well, though.
Yeah, well,
she speaks without notes. She can. She can do a throne speech without notes,
right.
but she can perform.
Yeah,
right? I mean,
yeah.
as well as huh. as anybody.
Interesting. Yeah.
I just thought they would take advantage of the new. Their brand new House of Commons to do a brand new throne speech. And
the world has changed a little bit.
Well, although actually, something that our CP's Joan Bryden has reported on is actually how little has been done to prepare, because Senator Block is shut down.
Yeah, that's right.
They've moved the House of Commons, they've moved the Senate, and some of those spaces aren't actually ready. And the people have to be in those places.
Yeah,
they've got
to do that. Yeah.
They haven't figured out. You know, some guys actually got to walk with a ceremonial rod and bang on the
that's
door.
Right.
And at the moment, they're three blocks apart in downtown Ottawa,
right.
as opposed to just at opposite ends of the corridor. And they don't. I mean, these are not insurmountable problems, obviously.
Yeah.
But they haven't solved them.
Yeah.
So they don't actually know how to. This would be done.
I think that is hilarious too. Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah,
but it's a little thing.
But
imagine how embarrassing it would be to mess that up.
And if we,
for the purposes of resetting the government, and you know, usher the black rod slips on some ice.
Yeah,
or the environmentally friendly government commissions a bunch of buses to take everybody down to the Senate.
Wow, yeah, that would be field day. I can hear Aaron laughing. Okay, so lastly, and this is sort of a interesting one, again, more Canadian political news here, but former Canadian Prime Minister Kim Campbell has been given some heat over the last week after posting a tweet that referred to President Trump as a motherfucker. Yes, we can say it on here. this is in response to Trump's news conference about the government shutdown. He was arrogant in a response to a question about the need for like a safety net for these workers, these government workers who wouldn't be paid. So the tweet was made in reference to something similar said by newly elected Democratic Congresswoman Rashida, and I'm going to butcher this last name, but I'll try. Tlaib. She said, he really is a motherfucker, and then she has since deleted the tweet because it got so much uproar. So my question is, and I was thinking about this, do former prime ministers, and there's a short list of them, have a duty to uphold a certain presence, both online and offline, and should they be using this specific type of language, like motherfucker? I wonder how many times we can say it. on Twitter. Susan, what do you think?
Yep. Yes, I believe in. I'm very old fashioned, actually, about decorum and stuff. I got into a bit of trouble on Twitter myself when I called out Romeo Saganash for I forget what he said a swear word in the House of Commons too, and I made a kind of joke about it, and I got a barrage of accusations that I was a pearl clutching.
Oh boy.
Just to mix things up a bit, I think it's totally fine that Kim Campbell called him a motherfucker. And I'm wondering, I'll just throw this out there, whether it had been another former prime minister, say Brian Mulroney, who had done it.
I know.
When this Trump was dealing with being called that just the past couple of weeks, he said, oh, I worry about their family and, and there's an idea that women are supposed to be ladylike in politics,
yes, right?
There, that has infused the criticism of Kim Campbell, I'll say it because I'm a woman, in a way that I don't think I think people would have said, had Mulroney said it, had Jean Chrétien said it, oh, that's, it's not good and it's debasing the language, but, there would have been a ha-ha chuckle.
Yeah.
But there has been a little bit of Kim Campbell is a woman and shouldn't speak that way.
Yeah, and she's the only one and whatever. But I do think, I'm kind of mind, like, that language feels... I don't know, inappropriate for someone of that stature. And I maybe it is a bit old fashioned of me, but I don't think that a former prime minister should be using the term motherfucker on Twitter. And it's just because they've been given this position. And I was trying to look back at, read articles about what the role of the prime minister, former prime ministers are, and you know, different from that of a governor general and whatnot. But I feel like it's it just doesn't look classy. Is it classy the right word? Yeah, maybe. Doesn't look professional. Doesn't look you're almost like stooping to his level, I feel. It didn't sit well with me. What did you think, Dave?
I don't think it's a major offense.
No, it's not a major offense.
I think it's probably not helpful. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Canadian government has tied itself in knots to not tick off Donald Trump unnecessarily. And I don't think it's helpful for an ex-prime minister to be calling him names on Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been male politicians, including in the States, who've gotten grief for swearing within range of microphones and actually calling people names. I mean, I think Dick Cheney called a reporter a major league asshole or something
Right.
And Joe Biden complimented Barack Obama on a piece of legislation. I think he called it a big effing deal.
Off,
you know, within range of microphones, but they were not kind of public declarations. They were overhearings. I think if Brian Mulroney, you know, went out in public and called a U.S. president something, that's a little different from being caught saying, I mean, I'm sure Mulroney, you know, swears up a storm or has done in his time behind closed doors.
I think he'd be putting
in remarks not meant for public consumption.
Yeah.
But I think if he did it deliberately and as provocatively as Campbell did, I think he'd probably get some grief for it.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I don't want to stand too strongly on this. I make a point myself. I have a rule of I do not swear on Twitter.
Right.
And it's not because I want to be a nice young lady. It's because... young is out of the question, but it's because I want to not be taken seriously. And I, you know, would Kim Campbell do it again? Maybe not.
Yeah.
And she deleted the tweet.
Yeah, so she deleted the tweet. Yeah. And it's just respect. I think it's just a matter of like using respectful language.
I don't have a problem with the next prime minister swearing in public.
No.
I think in this particular case, it is not helpful to Canada.
Let's not.
But that's more of like a tactical thing, not the world is crumbling.
No.
It's just not a good idea.
We do have a prime minister who called a member of parliament a piece of shit.
And and
he does regret that as well. But
That's true. And I think that because I see this rise of nasty language on Twitter from people on all sides of the spectrum, I'm thinking, God, like, we just need to find – but Twitter's hard that way because it is so informal and it is so loose and you can be personal on it. And, I mean, I'm even thinking back to the conversation we had about Jim Watson and his Twitter stuff. And,
very cranky.
Yeah.
Does not reflect well in the office.
No, it doesn't. I mean,
an ex-prime minister is not an office.
It just, like, shows that you can get riled up and you can, you know, lash out a little bit. And it's like, no, just keep your cool. My question earlier was, is it different for someone like a governor general? But I don't even think that.
I think it would be different for a governor general because the whole point of a governor general is dignity.
Ceremony.
And to represent the best and to be unimpeachable. Ironic choice of words in the context of dealing with Donald Trump. But he or she has to represent the best of Canada.
Right.
And foul-mouthedness is not the best of Canada.
Right.
So for a current or even a former governor general, I think would reflect poorly on him or her or on the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's different for an ex-PM who is, you know, a commoner.
Yeah.
Be great to put in a throne speech, though, eh?
Yeah. That's the idea. Okay, we can loop it all together. All right, well, that's it for today. Thanks so much for joining me, David and Susan. Can I have your handles, please, your Twitter handles?
At David Reevely. Easy as pie.
Same thing here, at Susan Delacorte.
Awesome. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.
Hey everyone, Mira here from Canada 2020. I have some news I wanted to share with you all. For those who are interested in working with Canada 2020, our 2019 internship program is now accepting applications for a February start with our Ottawa team. So if you're looking to gain practical experience working on the ground in either operations or organization, or if you're interested in producing podcasts and working with the 2020 Network, apply to become an intern today. Get your applications in by January 17th. Head to Canada2020.ca for more information. Last week, I was at the cottage and I realized I had to pay back a friend. Using my phone, it only took a few seconds. Canadians are always on the move, And with Interac e-Transfer, it's easy for us to access our money. Interac e-Transfer enables consumers and businesses to send, receive, and request money securely, anytime and anywhere. Visit interac.ca to learn more.